Case number 14-1036 et al. Center for Biological Diversity et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency. Ms. Gooding for the petitioners, Mr. Antoine for the respondent.
Let's wait till the courtroom clears. All right, Ms. Gooding, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amanda Gooden, and I represent the conservation groups in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We are here today because EPA approved a new toxic pesticide for nationwide use without first consulting with the federal wildlife agencies. This consultation is a necessary and legally required step for EPA to figure out what protections are needed for endangered species. EPA doesn't dispute that it didn't consult, and it doesn't seriously dispute that it should have. The main questions for this court today concern jurisdiction and remedy. I'd like to address 3 points on those topics. First, the conservation groups have standing to bring this claim. Second, because there was no public hearing, jurisdiction over this claim is proper in district court. And third, EPA's failure to consult violates the Endangered Species Act, and the conservation groups are entitled to a remedy for that violation. Turning first to standing.
I don't want to disrupt your order here, but on the last question, doesn't EPA concede that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's nothing for us to decide on your third point.
Remedy is appropriate, Your Honor, I believe is the question before the court.
You mean just whether what we say when we, if you have standing and if you're in the right court, what we say when we remand it, right?
Correct. We're asking
and
for
do,
an
do
order.
Do I understand the only difference between the parties on that is that you want a deadline and the EPA doesn't, correct?
That's the difference, Your Honor, yes. They want a remand with nothing more.
Well, you all agree no vacature, but you want a deadline, they don't want one, right?
Correct.
Okay. Could I ask you to start on the second issue first?
Yes, Your
jurisdiction.
Honor.
You said that you say it shouldn't be here because there was no adversarial hearing, right?
Correct.
But what do you do with our cases? What do you do with EDF versus COSL? It says the question about jurisdiction, it turns on whether the record is adequate. If it's adequate, it should be here. If it's not adequate, it should be in the district court.
Your Honor, COSL did look to that legislative history, and
well, that's what it holds. I mean, it holds that.
It held that in the context of that agency process, the record was adequate, and so it should come here. But, Your Honor, in COSL, there was only one statutory provision this court was looking at, and that was the judicial review provision. Here we have two, and that changes things. The court is looking not just at the language of the judicial review provision, but also at the plain statutory language governing the registration process. So in COSL, the agency's decision, the agency process there, is not one that the statute directly speaks to. The agency was deciding who could request a public hearing, a cancellation hearing specifically. And so this court looked at what the agency actually did and said, well, the record is adequate, judicial policy supports review in this court. and so found review appropriate here. But
so if it, so, I just don't understand what this is about. The two questions before us are standing, correct?
Correct.
Now, the record's completely adequate on that, isn't it? We have, it's this typical standing record we have here day after day in this court, right? A bunch of affidavits on both sides.
Correct.
You wouldn't, there's nothing that needs to be supplemented on that, right?
We feel there's not.
Okay, and on the merits, there isn't any, right? We don't need a record to decide whether to impose a deadline or not, correct?
It's a question of law, Your Honor. There's
Yeah, so what sense, and we're, our review is de novo on both questions, right?
Correct.
So just explain to me why the case is here, right? It's on a petition.
And also,
there's no question about the adequacy of the record. So what's the possible reason to send this back for the district court to do what we could do in the next half hour?
Because Congress, Your Honor, in the statute specified that only actions following a public hearing would come here.
What, in your view, is a public hearing?
Well, the Act describes a public hearing process as a cancellation or suspension proceeding. Now, in the legislative history and in this Court's decision in Costell, the Court held that it could be more than that, but it didn't define the limits of what a public hearing could be for purposes.
There's a doctrine that grew up in the early 1970s, defining what a hearing was after the Supreme Court's decision in Goldberg versus Kelly. And the Supreme Court said, 1973 in Florida East Coast, that the hearing doesn't have to be what we lawyers think of as a oral presentation, cross-examination of witnesses and everything else. It can be a hearing on paper. And that's how Social Security claims have been handled now for years, despite the fact that the Supreme Court said that the individuals are entitled to a hearing. The hearing doesn't have to be an oral one. And the Supreme Court has adopted that doctrine, so have lower courts. But so why isn't this what occurred here in the rulemaking proceeding, a hearing on paper?
Because we have specific statutory language describing a different process, using different words to describe that process, and that's notice and comment for new registrations. And in fact, it would introduce redundancy into the statutory text because the statute also provides for a public hearing appeal, an administrative appeal from that notice and comment process. And if Congress thought these were the same thing and should both be reviewed in the same place, then there's no reason for a registration
well,
decision.
Actually, there is. If what you have is an EPA interpretation of a particular regulation or statute, there's no need for EPA in that type of a situation to engage in any kind of notice and comment. And so there wouldn't be any public hearing in that situation if a hearing on paper is the equivalent. And I suppose those cases could go to the should go to the district court in light of the statute. So there are situations that are equivalent to having no hearing at all.
Mm-hmm. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that for the registration process specifically, the statute always requires that to be a notice and comment process. But where a pesticide applicant is disappointed, they can then go on and request a full public hearing, an adjudicative hearing under the Act. So if Congress thought the notice and comment record was always going to be the equivalent or equal to the full adjudication record, there's no real reason to have that whole second appeal route if Congress intended the notice and comment record to be the basis.
If I'm understanding you correctly, then what you're saying is that the public hearing requirement is met only if there's been an adjudication, and it cannot be met if there's been a rulemaking. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know that I would say it must always be an adjudication, but here when we have different statutory language describing a different process.
Well, if it's not an adjudication, what is it? If it's not an adjudication, it's not a rulemaking, what is it?
Well, Your Honor, it has, in the cases that this Court has considered, it's always been an adjudication. But we think the notice and comment process for registration review that the Act describes separately, that can't be swallowed into public hearing because of the very different statutory language that they are. I would also note that the legislative history that this Court looked to in Costell, the discussion of the adequacy of the record, That appears in the context of two pages discussing cancellation and suspension hearings. There's no discussion of notice and comment or of registrations, new registrations in that section. That same Senate report does discuss new registrations in an entirely different section of the report. Talks about notice and comment. It doesn't talk about hearings, and it doesn't have any indication that review would be here.
Are you familiar with Florida East Coast?
I am, Your Honor.
Let me read to you what a specific statutory mandate that the proceedings take place on the record after hearing may be satisfied in some circumstances by submissions in written form.
But, Your Honor, here we have the structure of the statute distinguishing between the adjudicative hearings and the cancellation and suspension procedures on the one hand and the registration process on the other. And when faced with agency decisions that didn't fit in either of those buckets, which was the case in Costell and the case in Humane Society, this Court looked at what the agency did and said, okay, that should be a public hearing. The record is adequate. We believe sound policy supports review in this Court. But we're not dealing with a no-man's land here. We're not dealing with an agency decision that the statute does not speak to and does not dictate. We have a process Congress specified, and they used very different words to describe that process than the words they used to describe the processes that should go to the courts of appeals.
So can I go back to I just have a very practical question.
Yes.
So you spent a lot of energy and time in your briefs arguing you should be in the district court. Yet you agreed with me that the record is adequate as it is for both standing and the merits, right?
Correct.
So just what difference does it make to you?
Your Honor, in this case, we really don't think it does make a difference. We simply want our claim to be heard. But
I see.
Because
I'm not missing anything about it.
No.
Okay.
But
you just think, you think the statute says what it does, and therefore it should be in the district court. But you don't have any practical. In fact, wouldn't you, let's assume we thought you had standing. You would get relief a lot faster here, right now.
In this particular case, we would, Your Honor. But again, we have concerns about the 60-day notice requirement in the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. Are you worried about other cases, future cases?
Yeah, but the EPA has not argued in this case that there's no jurisdiction for that reason. But if we had brought only a claim here, we felt that we would be vulnerable to that.
Oh, I don't blame you for bringing a claim in both courts. That was a very wise choice. But now that you're here, other than your argument about what the statute means, you don't really care, right?
In this case, no. But in this type of claim, the specific effects on endangered species, this is a rare case. EPA concedes that it did not follow the law.
Right. So if you had, let's assume tomorrow you get another case where instead of EPA conceding that it didn't comply with that, it argues that it did. It did comply.
Mm-hmm.
Now there you would have a record problem, right? You would have a question in that case about, is the record adequate?
Correct.
And if it isn't, it needs to be in the district court.
Correct.
Okay.
But, Your Honor,
but that's not this case.
But I believe
this is a very strange case. I mean,
it is a strange case, Your Honor.
I have to say, this is one of the oddest cases I've ever seen. Okay, so we're required, prior to Steel Co., we would have simply decided the merits here and remanded it. But we can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We now have to decide standing. So here we have a case where, we have to decide standing first, but there's no merits, right?
Right. There's no merits dispute.
It's so strange.
Your Honor, on the jurisdictional point, I think it creates a very challenging
situation. There's a famous Civil War general who once said in the middle of a battle, this is like living upstairs over a vacant lot, which is what this case is like.
It is something like that, Your Honor.
Other than standing. I've never seen anything like this.
Your Honor, I would just note quickly that to make the adequacy of the record the only consideration here, without any reference to the process that produced that record, means that the parties will have to potentially fight over whether the record is adequate or not before figuring out which court has jurisdiction to hear the claim. And I don't think that's what Congress intended. They said following a public hearing, which indicates that a specific type of agency process was what they had.
I understand. I just don't understand. You're worried about this pesticide.
Yes.
You can get your fastest relief right here, assuming we think you have standing. The only reason you might not is if the district court, if we didn't, then didn't think you had standing, but the district court did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether that's part of your calculation or not.
Your
you're
going
to get a lot faster relief here if we think you have standing. then you have to go all the way back to the district court, because the government has said it's going to raise standing there, right?
It has. We feel that we have adequately demonstrated that we have standing for this court and for the district court as well.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Anatoly.
May it please the court, my name is Travis Anatoly, and I'm with the Department of Justice, and I'm representing the Environmental Protection Agency. I'd like to address first the district court's order dismissing the senator's complaint, and then move on to
Am I right about this case, that if we think petitioner is standing, then the EPA, the government, agrees that it's got to go back, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what's the reason why, given that's the government's position, and I realize you're from the Justice Department and you don't have to answer this question, obviously you don't know, but if the agency agrees it has to do the endangered species analysis, and you and the petitioner both agree that that the registration shouldn't be vacated, just remanded, why doesn't EPA just do it? Why are we spending all our time trying to figure out whether these people are standing?
Well, Your Honor, we did have some settlement discussions. They were fruitless. I think it's important to understand that this case comes against a backdrop of now going on a decade's worth of efforts to streamline and synthesize the interaction between FIFRA and the endangered species.
So is your concern, let me just cut to the chase here, is your concern that the remedy, if there's a remedy here, it will upset the way the agency has prioritized its efforts to comply with the statute? In other words, as I understand it from your brief, the agency has decided to do the most risky pesticides first, right? And it thinks this pesticide is less risky, right?
That's correct.
So is the agency's concern that if the petitioners win, it will force the agency to move quicker on a less risky pesticide than on the more risky ones? Is that what's going on here?
That's part of the concern, Your Honor.
Is there another part?
Yes. I think the other part is that the agencies are still working on creating a framework for this type of consultation. For many years, the EPA was under a good faith belief that the ESA Section 7 requirements did not apply up front at the national level. And it was only since around the time of Washington Toxics that the agency learned that, in fact, it was required to consult. At that point, there were over 1,100 active ingredients that required consultation, dating back decades. And these consultations are huge nationwide undertakings. They go not just to the particular species at issue, which may number in the thousands. They go to agricultural use and climate, geography. It requires a wealth of modeling and cooperation between not just the three agencies, but all the affected parties, all the stakeholders. So part of it is, Your Honor, this worry about line cutting, but part of it is, in some sense, the mechanisms simply aren't there yet to effectuate the type of consultation that EPA and the services, the expert services, would like.
Okay.
Your Honor, I do want to just briefly touch on the two jurisdictional issues addressed by the district court, then move on to standing. With respect to the public hearing question, Your Honor, as you noted,
Well, you agree the case should be here, right?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
Okay, all right.
I just wanted to emphasize, with respect to the public hearing, the process that occurred here. EPA did undertake two rounds of notice and comment. Mm-hmm. It took dozens of comments, responded to those comments in detail, including comments from petitioners, and compiled a 100,000-page record, which is more than enough to evaluate the legal issues before the court today. Secondly, going back to at least City of Rochester v. Bond, what this court has held with respect to bifurcated review statutes like FIFRA, is that where Congress determines that review of particular agency actions should be in the Court of Appeals, that necessarily ousts competing grants of jurisdiction to the district courts in independent statutes. And that's exactly how FIFRA operates vis-a-vis the ESA. And indeed, if one looks at plaintiff's complaint and petitioner's petition, it's very clear that their challenges bound up with the ESA are inextricable from the challenge to a pesticide mm-hmm. registration order. If there's no further questions on the district court's order of dismissal, I would like to discuss standing. The court should dismiss the center's petition for want of standing because petitioners have not demonstrated an actual and imminent injury as required by Article 3, but only an abstract conjectural injury. And in particular, I want to stress that this court has been very exacting and careful in reviewing standing declarations where, as here, petitioners premise their theory of injury not only on the actions of third parties not before the court, in this case, the end users of signed Miniprol, but also an additional set of third parties, the regulated parties, the interveners. So there's a fairly long causal chain from the onset. And in this case, petitioners haven't met their burden for at least three reasons.
Let me ask you about your first point, that the petitioners haven't shown that farmers will use it. EPA itself says that this is the most effective pesticide. It says, quote, it's an essential tool to citrus growers and blueberry farmers, which are under serious threat. And it says this pesticide is the most effective alternative for combating these invasive insect. So, why isn't that enough? The producers of this have spent a huge amount of money getting this pesticide registered. EPA says it's the most effective. Isn't it fairly obvious that the farmers will use it?
Yes, Your Honor. We don't contest as a general principle that end users of cyanotroniliprole will use cyanotroniliprole.
I see.
What we're contesting is the showing by petitioners
that
users near the declarants and near the declarants professed species of interest will use cyanotroniliprole. And in cases where this court has...
Well, the record shows this overlap between where these two insects are and where blueberry and citrus farms are. Now, you disagree about the extent of the overlap, but the evidence shows there's an overlap. So what else do they need to show?
Well, Your Honor, we think they need to show at least two more pieces of evidence.
Yeah.
The first thing they need to show is that cyanotroniliprole will actually adversely affect these particular species. What the risk assessment prepared by EPA shows is that based on representative samples, the pesticide is harmful at most at the level of taxa.
Yeah, but that's to things like birds and mammals, not... Didn't the risk assessment say it was risky to insects?
At the level of taxa, it is, generally speaking.
Well, they have a study that says, your own study says it's risky to insects. This beetle and this butterfly are insects. What more do they need? I mean, EPA could come forward with evidence that it's not toxic to these two insects, but that's the only question before us, and I don't see that evidence.
Well, Your Honor, to clarify, what the risk assessment does not say is that cyanotroniliprole is harmful to all insects. It just is predictive in general, saying that there may be some concern to insects. But the risk assessment does.
But there's also the question of what, if the citrus farms and the blueberry growers are having problems now without this pesticide, that doesn't mean they're not using any pesticide. They're using some sort of pesticide that is not as effective. And so there's room in there, it seems to me, for a comparative analysis. If the pesticides they're using now are killing more insects that are not threatening the farms, and this pesticide would not, then it's a net gain, not a net loss.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is certainly a plausible scenario. Candidly, the EPA and petitioners, according to their brief, don't know how the pesticides affect particular species because the framework for consultation isn't there. It is plausible, though, that certain species are better off in this case. I think the point is that...
Doesn't the record say that this pesticide is more effective and less harmful? In fact, I think I think the DuPont study suggests that farmers will use this. This is more effective. This will be used in addition to the existing pesticides, right?
It could, in theory. Right. Part of the problem with the declarants here is that there's just no information as to what's happening on the ground in these particular mm-hmm. locations, the particular overlaps which have been the basis for the court's jurisdiction in mm-hmm. cases like the Sierra Club cases from 2014, when petitioners haven't been able to show that nexus, as in Florida Audubon, as in the Sierra Club case from 2002.
Is there anything in the record indicating that whatever pesticide is being used now is less expensive than this particular product would be?
Yeah, I'm not aware of it.
The reason a farmer wouldn't use it, even though it's more effective, is because it's much more expensive. I'm thinking of personal experience. There's a new pesticide out called Tenacity that kills nimble wilt, which I unfortunately have in my lawn. So I thought, oh, this is great. It's the only selective one. And so I got on the internet, and it was $990 a gallon. So I decided to pass.
I'm not aware of anything in the record that breaks down the pesticides by cost, but I will say that there are additional reasons to use varying pesticides, including human health. And what the record does establish is that for farm workers, especially, cyanotenilaprole will be less toxic than its counterparts.
And what is the term EPA uses for saying that the pesticide is less dangerous to humans? There's a particular term they use.
In the risk assessment, it's generally labeled as less toxic. The specific measurements are labeled as risk quotients, which is essentially exposure over the denominator, which is levels of the pesticide which are harmful under certain measurements to each individual species. But generally, it's just referred to as toxicity.
Let me make sure. So we understand from the risk assessment that it is toxic to insects generally, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So is there anything in the record that says it's not toxic? Well, let me ask you, is there anything in the record that says it's less toxic than other insecticides?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. To insects.
Yes, I think the most concrete example I can give you on that point is vis-a-vis honeybees. So,
okay, but we're not talking about honeybees here. These people are watching beetles and butterflies. But they're not worried about bumblebees, honeybees. What about these two insects?
There is nothing. Yeah. In the record that demonstrates right. conclusively that this pesticide
right.
is
so
better.
So the burden is on the petitioner, and they've cited EPA study which says it's toxic to insects. And the only insect that I know of, as you just pointed out, that it isn't toxic to in the record is the honeybee. So isn't it EPA's burden to come forward with evidence that, yes, it's toxic generally to insects, but A, it's either not toxic to these two bugs, or it's less toxic than other insecticides. Those two things I don't see in the record.
Well, it would be our burden, respectfully, Your Honor. Right. We disagree that petitioners have made the prima facie showing that, in fact, cyanotenilaprole is harmful to these particular insects. The National Academy report spells this out very clearly, that it's impossible to draw conclusions regarding the effects to particular species from documents like the risk assessment. That's the whole point uh-huh. of further consultation. And beyond that, the only other point I'd make with uh-huh. respect to standing
yeah.
is that the nexus is so unclear between uh-huh. these species and these petitioners and cyanotenilaprole use. One of the tightest overlaps we could find alleged in petitioners' declarations was in that of Martha Crouch. She alleges that she's concerned about sandhill cranes in Jasper County, which is around 560 square miles, because there are allegedly 100 acres of blueberry farms in Jasper County. Now, even assuming that cyanotenilaprole is harmful to cranes and that all 100 acres use cyanotenilaprole, that overlap turns out to be only 0.003% of Jasper County. And we think under Summers, which held that an 800-square-mile nexus was insufficient to show standing under the circuit's cases like Sierra Club and Florida Audubon, like I've mentioned, that's far too thin a read to premise an injury in fact on. And as I've said, that's one of the tightest overlaps we've found.
This particular pesticide does not accumulate in the soil. What is it, dissipate into the atmosphere?
Well, it's less likely to bioaccumulate than its counterparts. Right. It does degrade into multiple components, and those are assumed to have the same toxicity as cyanotimidazole itself.
And it's less harmful to honeybees, you said, which is a big deal because without honeybees, you don't get fruit and you don't get bluebirds.
That's correct. The appendix at 442 and 500 spells out how, especially compared to organophosphates and other pesticides, cyanotimidazole, from what we know, is generally less toxic to honeybees.
The toxicity studies are they species specific or general?
I can try to answer your question by spelling out the consultation process in a bit more detail. There's three levels. The first is a screening level assessment where what the EPA does is it tries to rule out no effect determinations for an entire taxa. And for at this level, which is what the court has in front of it, it uses representative species.
The EPA hasn't done that in this case, right?
It has done that, Your Honor.
Has or hasn't?
It has. That's the risk assessment that's in the appendix. So,
well, what does this sentence mean in you say, should the court read the merits of this claim, EPA does not contest that it has not made an effects determination. By the way, that's a good reason why you shouldn't use a lot of knots in a sentence. Go ahead.
Noted,
Your Honor. Excuse me, but doesn't that mean EPA has not made the effects determination?
Well, so following the National Academy report in 2013, EPA huddled with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, and what came out of that process and what came out of the National Academy report was following this screening level assessment, which is what we have now. So EPA looks at onions or rainbow trout. Uh-huh. It then goes back and it really refines the models, uh-huh, and it takes a hard look at a species life cycle, the geography, uh-huh, where the species lives. It looks at the agricultural patterns, the climate, and it tries to much more thoroughly document how the species could be affected. Uh-huh. And the EPA has done this for three trial pesticides. It's just finished that in December. And it's only at that stage that it makes the may affect determination.
I see. So that hasn't happened in this case.
That has not happened.
I get you. Okay. That's all right. Now I understand. Okay.
I see I'm well past my time.
So if it goes back, if it is remanded, the EPA will have to do that first, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it could conclude based on that it then doesn't need to consult with the endangered species people.
At that stage, it would render a not likely to adversely affect determination. If the expert agencies concur, there's no further consultation.
Gotcha. Okay. That was helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points on standing to start. The action we have here before us is EPA's decision to authorize this pesticide. There are certainly other threats to these species, but nothing in EPA's decision here requires that any other pesticide be used less as a condition of this pesticide's use. If EPA had actually said in its decision this pesticide can only be used where these other more toxic pesticides aren't used, would have a very, very different fact pattern. That's not what we have. And we have EPA and the registrant saying we expect it will be used in addition to other pesticides. I agree, Judge Tatel, that the general statements in the risk assessment that it is toxic to this taxa do meet our prima facie showing that there is likely harm to these specific species within that taxa, and we have nothing that would indicate to the contrary. I also want to turn back quickly to kind of what this case is about.
Could you say a little more about standing?
Yes, of course.
I understand your point about how you think you've met your burden that it's likely to be used. But what about the overlap problem?
Your Honor,
could you say something about that?
Yes, we've identified species, for example, the Mitchell Sater butterfly, which exists only in the largest blueberry-growing county in Michigan, which is the largest blueberry-growing state in the country, and we've shown that this butterfly's habitat is in and around these blueberry fields. This is one of the crops that EPA has said it is desperately needed, cyanotrienolipol, to combat in these crops. And so we think
Michigan
it is...
Michigan is the largest blueberry producer? I thought it was New Jersey.
Michigan is by acreage. I think New Jersey might be by volume.
Oh.
And is this in your reply brief, the response to the DuPont analysis? Is that where that is?
Yes. We have an additional declaration
right.
that is attached to our reply
That's
brief.
That's Mr.
Bradley, I believe.
And so tell me what that you think that shows.
We think it shows substantial overlap between agricultural uses and this butterfly.
Uh-huh.
And we've also shown that the
predominant... Is that the 93%? Is that number, 93?
There are a few. I would have to pull the exact
What is the number?
Number
that I should be looking at?
There are a few different analyses in that. So it looks at the what's called an elemental occurrence, which is a specific time that butterfly was sighted. That overlap for the butterfly was 92.4%.
That's what I thought, yeah. And that's overlap where there are blueberry fields, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The agricultural areas don't distinguish by crop. It's where there are agricultural areas, so we can't tell whether those are blueberry fields or not, but we do know that it is the biggest by acre blueberry producing county in the country.
I see. Okay, thanks. I get it. What were you going to say did you have something else to say about standing? Is there anything else you want to say about standing?
Just that, Your Honor, this case does not present the kind of chain of attenuation that this court has found unacceptable in other cases. We're simply saying that it is likely that this pesticide will be used in exactly the ways that EPA is saying that it is likely that it will be used. I see that I'm out of time, so we would ask this court to reverse the district court and remand.
Thank you.